This morning, the second of our interviews with the people vying to become Prime Minister after tomorrow night's election. Yesterday, it was the National Party leader, Judith Collins. This morning, it's the Labour Party leader, Jacinda Ardern. Ms Ardern, the MP for Mount Albert, entered Parliament in 2008. She became leader of the Labour Party just before the last election and became Prime Minister following coalition negotiations after that 2017 election. Ms Ardern, good morning and welcome to Nine to Noon.
Morena.
Can we begin with COVID? What is the management plan for COVID? If there is no viable vaccine broadly available in New Zealand, say in the first part of next year, what is the management plan?
We would continue on with the approach that we've already taken. In our view, and in fact all of the, you know, all the measures and indicators that matter to us in terms of people's health and well-being, but also the economy, have demonstrated that that plan of stamping it out every time we have a case, going hard and going early, has really worked for us. So we would continue with that. You ask about a vaccine. Actually, the progress that's being made there is good. You'll have seen that New Zealand already has purchase arrangements for vaccinations that are set to be delivered in 2021. So at the moment, of course, everyone is angling their plans towards that time frame.
All right. The New Zealand expert linked to the Oxford trial has told us the best case is some availability of a vaccine with some degree of efficacy, perhaps by the middle of next year.
Yep.
I heard the optimism of your minister early this week over vaccine prospects.
Mm.
But do you accept there's a lot of maybes? And what is the plan if you don't get what you hope for?
Yeah. And so, look, the Oxford trial, obviously, they're actually not necessarily the first cab off the rank. It seems that another pharmaceutical company is looking to deliver somewhat earlier. What New Zealand's strategy is, let's make sure that we're in a range of queues. There will not be just one vaccine. There'll be a range. Some will be delivered at different points. Some will be perhaps one dose. Some will be two. Some will have different cold chain requirements. Our strategy is making sure that we are there in amongst all of those options so that vaccination can be quick. However, your question is, what if? And look, no one is theorising that there won't be anything. No one is suggesting that there won't be anything that helps with disease, with treatment. So we can bank at least on there being something that eases the experience we're having now. Timeframes are a legitimate question. It could be that we're waiting until the latter part.
Do those borders fundamentally stay closed until there is an efficacious and available vaccine?
Your options are either you have a regime like we've got now where you use your borders, or you live with the virus.
Do you have a plan for doing that if that ends up being our reality?
Our plan continues to be that using the border is the best way to keep people safe. However,
yep,
there are some alterations to that. You know, we have prioritised bringing in our residents and our citizens for good reason. We've got to bring people home. But there is a way that we can have a greater range of people coming in at the border. So that will mean that we can have a bit more flexibility, particularly economically, using the border restrictions.
We've heard from National some quite deliberate plans, testing in advance, for example, perhaps making more quarantine facilities available.
Yep.
I don't want you to comment on the viability of those plans.
Mm.
That's for them.
Yep.
I want to look at where your government or a government that you would lead would be at in preventing further lockdowns. There have been failures at the border that almost certainly led to that second lockdown in Auckland. There have been failures at the border just ahead of that. Only 500 of an estimated 7,000 border and isolation workers were tested in the first week of August. 5 days later, the first cases of that second outbreak were reported. Can you say now that your border system and that your contact tracing system is in a place to prevent any more lockdowns?
Two things. If you rely only on testing of your border workers, then you're waiting for COVID to get through. It cannot just be about that. We have double arrangements, safety provisions at the border around the way that staff are cared for, kept separate from at-risk passengers, the use of PPE, and testing. And after, you know, that resurgence that we experienced, we tested all our MIQ, all our border workers.
Should it have been happening beforehand?
Yes.
That is the point.
Yes.
And it wasn't.
And Catherine, we have said absolutely. You can see from every decision we made, we had that expectation and that we were ramping up, that it wasn't meeting our expectation. And every time we've seen a failure, we have fixed
it. The question is, can you fix things before they happen? Because would you agree, Auckland cannot tolerate another lockdown like it had?
Auckland cannot tolerate a coexistence with COVID.
Understood, but You've had 7 months now, getting on to 8 months, dealing with this issue. And what I'm asking you is, between the contact tracing improvements and what is happening at border now, through whatever mechanism, are you at a point where you can assure the country we will not be having further lockdowns?
Catherine, no one in the world, no one in the world...
Few have would, gone.
No one,
few have gone for elimination. You have.
No
That's
one,
the price we paid.
And we've made a very, I think, the right choice for New Zealand. But no one in the world would be able to ever give a cast iron guarantee that you would never, ever have a presence of a virus. And so I think we just have to look around. There is a counterfactual here, and it's the globe. At a time when everyone else is cracking down on extra restrictions, we are in this position. It is not going to be perfect, but every time we've seen something that we can improve, we have done it.
What has changed in the last 8 weeks? One thing that has reduced the risk of further lockdowns?
Well, everything that we do is about making those improvements. So if we see an issue, even in our MIQ, that can improve infection control, we'll do it. We are working at the moment on getting saliva testing ready to go. One of the reasons, and this is really fascinating, Catherine, one of the reasons we don't have saliva testing used yet is New Zealand's threshold for how accurate these tests need to be is very high. Most countries, they have COVID in their country, so they're looking for fast and quick. We have to be accurate because we have no tolerance for it.
So saliva testing we've heard discussed.
Yep.
I'm not hearing anything else in the 8 weeks since that outbreak started. There's still no extra technology yet to assist with contact tracing beyond the Mark 1 COVID app.
I can speak
app.
To that if you'd like
Please.
Me to. So the COVID app, we're making constant improvements there. The thing that the team's working on at the moment is the use of that Bluetooth technology within the app. So I expect that over the next couple of weeks we'll see some final work on that and we'll have more to say.
So
that's
you,
continued on despite
so
the campaign.
Will Bluetooth capacity in that app be introduced in the next...
My expectation is that we'd see that likely ready to go before the end of the year.
How significant will it be? What will it achieve?
It won't be a silver bullet, and that's where I think
What would be different about my COVID app now other than me scanning it?
I can finish the description there. So basically at the moment we're using our app as a tool to record people's movements. The Bluetooth element, and of course Google and Apple have been doing work here as well, the Bluetooth element and allows us to have apps, basically devices talking to each other to say when they've been in proximity to one another.
So when I pass you in the street, and lots of people are at the moment, and you are later... hopefully not, detected with COVID.
Then you
will
would be able
my
to...
app alert, are we within weeks of that application being
Look, I'm not going to... I'm going to be careful to put... When you're working with app development, be very careful about putting a hard and fast. But that is what's being worked on now. What I would be cautious about is there are a lot of countries that have... Singapore's one of them, Australia's one of them, that have used this technology and it has not been a silver bullet. So we've never pitched it that it will be. The most important thing, and the World Health Organization will say this, will always be your people on the ground.
Finally... Are you thinking at all of some of what the likes of South Korea have done or Taiwan have done, South Korea in particular, which is saying we're going to access your phone records, we're going to access your credit card records so that we can trace with precision and speed? Are you countenancing that?
Yeah, so we've already, our contact tracers will already say to people, let's look at your bank statements, let's look at your phone records.
You won't seek legislation or regulation to go directly to ISPs.
Even then, it's not necessarily accurate enough. It won't necessarily tell you the proximity you've been to someone. So again, not a silver bullet. The one other thing we're trialling at the moment is a COVID card. That's been trialled. It's just about, we're midway through a trial in Rotorua. Instead of a phone, you carry a card that talks to other cards. So we are exploring
the
all
thing
of
is,
these.
That's been explored for months. You had Sam Morgan walk away from it and say this is all happening too slow.
It's been delayed because the technology on it has been found to not be delivering what it needs. So they've done some work. That's what a trial is for. They've rejigged it and then the trial is back underway again.
Is the Health Ministry the right lead agency for the kinds of decisions that will need to be made from now and throughout 2021? Particularly if we have to learn to manage COVID differently. Is it the right lead for all these things, technology included?
It's been more than a health response, which is why right at the beginning, through my department, we set up an all of government group so that we were bringing together every agency. So it hasn't been strictly just a health lead. Obviously, everything we've done has been driven by health.
Are you looking at a different lead agency after this election?
I wouldn't strictly say that it would be fair to say that health is our sole lead as it is. We have used that centralised all of government group to drive the work that we're doing.
Are you looking at a different agency to
No, not being considered? Not different from the structure we have now, but I'm not saying as well that health, I would say, is our singular lead. We've used a grouping together of every agency because it spanned across MB, across customs.
Is that why people say some of this stuff is just happening too slowly?
No, it's because it's a pandemic that no one has experienced before, Catherine. And I've always said there was no rule book. But actually, New Zealand's done a pretty damn good job of creating one.
Surveys have shown a high level of trust in your leadership over the emergency COVID response. Some surveys, however, show lower levels of trust over whether your government should lead the economic recovery. What is your fundamental bullet point plan for the worst economic situation we have been in decades?
It has got to span across skills and trade training, preparing our people for the future. Now, to give you a very quick example there, just last week I was at EIT in Gisborne. Because of that free apprenticeship and vocational training program, they've already seen an increase in the number of participants there for primary production
and so on. Bullet points, if you forgive me. I had to push Ms. Collins. I have to push you. Bullet points.
So jobs are jobs, as long as investing in our people, jobs, so infrastructure, creating those jobs, building back better, so looking at the opportunities for the future, backing our small businesses and backing our exporters.
The headlines, and I just did ask you for bullet points, to be fair.
Let's
dig in a little deeper, though, because let's look at these numbers. Unemployment set to peak at 7.8% next year, but stays higher for longer, into the 7s, into 2024. Budget deficits for the next 15 years under your plan. Tourism, our biggest export earner, in tatters. And the global economy is the elephant in the room. Things may well get worse for New Zealand.
And let's look at the counterfactual on that. We've got record apprenticeship enrolments right now, over 5,000 relative to closer to 2,000 last year. Our exporters, particularly in dairy and meat and kiwi fruit and wine, all going gangbusters.
Yes, they're doing great. You're not going to tell me that we're not heading for very, very difficult times
in
the next few years.
No, I'm also consents for building. No, I'm not. But what I am saying is that with this crisis comes opportunity, and we've got to focus on the opportunity we have.
You do, because your campaign has become Prime Minister. My job is to focus on these challenges. At a business breakfast in Auckland last Friday, one small manufacturing company owner told your finance spokesman it had seen its wages bill rise by up to a third under your government. Is this the time now to be adding even further to costs with another week's sick leave, with an increase in the minimum wage, for a business sector on the ropes in some places?
Well, not. Look, the first point I would make is just this morning, I was questioned on Radio New Zealand about what we're doing on child poverty. You know, for us, constantly we're having to balance the need to address the low wages of New Zealanders at the same time as making sure that our businesses and our economy thrives. The minimum wage is one way that we can continue to see people survive from the hours that they work. So we have raised the minimum wage. At the same time, we have seen a decrease in unemployment. We've seen the lowest levels of unemployment in a decade.
I don't think any economist in the country would say those statistics are going to be reliable in the long run. They're taking exceptional times.
Even in the global financial crisis, we saw increases in the minimum wage because there is stimulatory effect. People on low incomes earning money spend it in the economy.
To a small business right now, though, grappling, and in this city they are, trying to extricate themselves or deal with landlords, for example. In Queen Street, foot traffic's down to what it is for multiple reasons. To small businesses struggling just to hold the line right now, what do you offer them?
Yeah, and look, for them, you know, I would say, look at our record. Our first thought going into COVID was, what can we do to sustain our businesses, particularly our small businesses? So that wage subsidy, you know, that was all about supporting them.
Beyond that, and in the next 3 years.
If I can just finish. Yep. You know, it was also the small business loan scheme. They said to us, look, we can't access capital at the moment. We're having real issues staying afloat. Our banks aren't supporting us. So we stepped in. Interest-free loans. We've said now we'll extend those to get those businesses through the next couple of years and beyond. The other thing we've learnt from lockdown was businesses made technological changes that took us ahead leaps and bounds. Some moved to, if they were retailers, moved online. We made 5 years' worth of gains, according to McKinsey, in a short couple of weeks. We want to continue to support them on that. We'll have free vouchers, essentially, that support businesses in training. If it's cloud accounting they want to move to, or if it's moving their business online, we'll support them to do that for free.
One accountant suggested to us, actually, accounting professor, what you could do at the moment is give 100% depreciation on new investment in plant, and particularly in high-tech plant in the first year.
And we have moved those thresholds as well. In fact, $3 billion worth of tax changes to support business.
All right, let's look at your promises of 2017 and where we're at with them. The government struggled. The government you led struggled to deliver on many of its promises from 2017. Why?
Let's unpick that statement
We shall.
Good.
I've got a series of them. Why did you struggle to, say, deliver on transport promises or, most egregiously, on Kiwi Build? When you look back now, why?
Well, transport's actually quite straightforward, that one, and it's called MMP. You know, we had a particular, and here I'm only talking about rail, because actually, you know, if you want to look at what we've done more broadly in Auckland, Eastern Busway, Auckland Northern Corridor, actually there are a number of projects.
You stopped some previous projects and then you started them.
No, I don't think that's fair at all, but the one that I have raised by the opposition most frequently is rail to the airport. That was quite simply the fact that we were three parties in government and one did not agree with that project, so we couldn't get it through.
And Kiwi Build, fundamentally, what went wrong? Was it just wrong-headed in the first place?
No, I think that the scale, and I don't shy away from scale and ambition, because actually that's what the housing crisis needed and deserved. But we have to recognise, in trying new things, you won't always succeed. We didn't succeed. We changed the policy to, though, continue to meet a demand we have now. Right now, we've got the new challenge with COVID that developers, just like they did in the GFC, may not continue to build. So we've used the underwrite scheme from Kiwi Build to support ongoing development. So, yes, it hasn't created the at-scale build of affordable housing, but we are still using it to stimulate growth of affordable housing.
Okay. It was supposed to be 16,000 houses by now. It's more like 600.
We've got 1,000 being built as well.
All right. Yep. You made big promises on housing. House prices have continued to rise. The state housing list has quadrupled since the last election.
Two things on it. Look,
why has that happened?
Yeah, because we didn't turn people away. One of our big criticisms of the last government was that they altered the way they dealt with people coming to get on those lists to keep the list short. We have not done that. So we have a very realistic picture of housing need now. We've also housed, you know, over 17,000 people in our term. But here's the things that will make a difference. We need more state houses. When we came, we had decreasing stock. Houses were being sold. We stopped that. We started the build. We now have over 5,000 public housing places, and we've pledged an extra 8,000 as part of our COVID recovery.
The question is, why are we in this situation where we've got 20,000 people?
Because we have a housing shortage.
So let's keep going.
Catherine, to be fair, you've asked me what we do about it, and I'm trying to tell you we have to build houses, and that's exactly what we've committed to. No government has built as many houses as us since the 1970s.
What is going to break this? House prices doubled under the three-term Labor government. They doubled again under the three-term National government. They're up 27% year on year to August under your government. And goodness knows what's happened since. They're going to double again. Now, what is going to break this? Because Kiwi Build didn't work.
Two things. If you've got too much demand, then it's a problem. You know, so actually, we took out the demand that was coming from offshore. We thought that was wrong. It wasn't right that people offshore were buying our residential houses. So we knocked that out. We dealt with ring fencing of the way that our tax loopholes that allowed people to treat their properties, their investment properties, in a particular way. That helped. We now see, just as of this week, new data which shows that 25% of the market now are first home buyers. It's the highest it's been on record. But we have to keep building.
It's nearly seven times the average household income nationally.
Break it down, though. One of the fascinating things is actually in our city centres, the housing price growth in those recent months has been far outstripped by the regions.
Yeah, well, if you're in Auckland and Wellington, try to buy a night right now.
Wellington is particularly bad.
Here's the thing. What is going to break it? Now, you mentioned immigration. It was undoubtedly one of the drivers. You pledged last time to bring immigration back. It's artificially suppressed at the moment. But will you see a return to anything like the levels of immigration that we had beyond COVID. And there will be demand to come here. What is your policy on
that? And so for immigration, our view has been that we need to be much, much more careful that we are, both for those who are choosing to make the effort to come to New Zealand, that we are genuinely matching them to skills need. We've already made tweaks to the system to try and make sure that's the case. Obviously, this is a bit of a moot point for the next 12 months.
Will you cap it this term? And if so, where?
We haven't talked about artificial targets and numbers. It's about skills need because, you know, if you get too far down that track, then you have particular sectors that suffer because they can't access those that they need.
Isn't that how we reached a peak of 70,000, 80,000?
No, we were not targeted around skills need. We weren't making sure that people were coming in for high wage jobs. We had a situation where...
We need them picking at the moment. I know what you're going to say. I know that you're trying to move people in New Zealand to go fruit picking, and the pickers in the primary sector are saying we can't get them. We can't get them fast enough.
Yeah, Kiwi Fruit said that, and then they succeeded in delivering a bumper season using New Zealand workforce.
Right. So no cap set at this point on what immigration will be. The RMA is the other. You're moving not only to change it now, but you're saying you're going to repeal it, as is National.
Mm.
Why didn't we see movement on this over the last 3 years? If you now see that as a real block to why we can't build houses.
Grateful you've asked that question, because this has been one of my frustrations in the campaign. The only reason that we've been able to articulate exactly what we will do and what it will be replaced with is because I believe it was 2018 we started the process of doing the full review of the RMA. So that means we had a judge come in, do that work for us. He's proposed that we have this system now that scraps the RMA, replaces it with a Strategic Planning Act and a Built Environment Act, and we'll be able to start the term running.
Is that not 3 lost years? Could that not have happened in opposition?
No, because actually what we also made changes while we were in office in the meantime. We also, through COVID, have done a fast track bill, which means that we have projects that will be able to move quickly. And the comprehensive work, RMA is a significant complex piece of work, but we will be able to kick off the term
with a fresh
start.
And I know you've been asked it, and I'm going to ask it again. Do you want house prices to come down? Because right now it's 9 nudging 10 times the median household income in Auckland, and it's now nudging 7 times elsewhere.
But
they need to come back.
They can't keep increasing as they are.
But do they need to come back?
My answer to this is simple. Most people, this is the biggest asset they own. Their financial security is tied up in the home that they have. The problem with our market at the moment is those average prices are what they are because no one has been building in the affordable range, right? And that's, we need more affordable
houses. A generation has to deal with that unaffordability.
No, they do not. If you ask a first-time buyer in Auckland what the biggest hurdle for them has been, often they have been paying the rent that could sustain a mortgage. They haven't had the deposit. We've actually got to get down to the core nub of these issues: progressive home ownership, schemes that allow people to have a lower deposit to get into homes. They all make a difference, and that, Catherine, is why we have the highest number of first home buyers in the market now that we ever have.
On child poverty, you did introduce legislation reporting measures, and you say on 7 of those 9 measures you can report some improvements.
Yeah.
But those improvements are marginal. They're margin of error. And a key one, material hardship has got worse. Can you really say your government has shifted the dial at all?
Yes. Well, yes, I can. Unfortunately, this is one of the things that has been, you know, a massive bugbear and I'm trying to fix. None of the measures we have, none of the numbers we have actually paint the full picture. They are only a snapshot of our first 18 months in office. So the full effect of everything that we've done, the families package, which was $5 billion worth of investment, the work that we've done on food and schools, the work that we've done increasing the benefit, none of that has flown through into the stats. But they have made a difference to people's lives.
So what do you anticipate is going to happen to those targets?
Estimates.
We are in a recession followed by a deep trough.
Well, we know prior to COVID that we were estimated to bring between 50 and 70,000 children out of poverty. We know, though, that the number who will be experiencing hardship because of COVID will be worse. So we need to look again. I don't want to change my ambition, though, based on that. I don't want to change our targets because we still should have the ambition to halve child poverty over 10 years.
Is ambition for child poverty ambition? Is an excellent thing, but it's also execution, it's also delivery and results.
And And there is nothing that you can say to me that will change my view that we have on child poverty done more than any government in decades.
Here's the
no thing. One is proposing that you can fix child poverty in 3 years.
Here's the
you
thing.
Can't.
The economist Brian Easton has tracked the rise in child poverty in New Zealand back to the benefit cuts of the 1990s, despite some policy measures since. The introduction of working for families was one example. It has never significantly closed. Will a government you lead raise basic benefit levels significantly?
Well, firstly, we already did this year. Secondly, Brian Easton is right to point out what happened in the 1990s. We were the government that bought back a universal benefit for children. We did that in our first 100 days with the Best Out payment. And Catherine, the thing that gets missed a lot is we talk often about just a generic benefit increase. None of that takes into account that the Best Out payment went to families on benefits. The winter energy payment went to families on benefit. We had the $25 increase for families on benefits. And we indexed wages to benefits. So all of that for someone on a sole parent payment means more than $100 a week.
His point is nothing any government has done since those cuts has fundamentally changed the track of child poverty. Your ambition is actually to eliminate it by 2030.
I'm not talking about ambition. I'm talking about the things we have done. And Brian would probably agree with me that actually none of the reporting that he has to base his judgments on showed the complete picture of what we did in the last 3 years.
It may be an area that you have in common with the Greens. You've ruled out their wealth tax. You've said no way. Still saying that today?
Yes,
no way
while
well,
I'm
Prime Minister?
I've not changed my
opinion. So this may be an area...
I've said we will not in the next term be implementing the wealth tax.
You can do some dealing with the Greens. And are you open to... You mentioned working groups. Another one that you set up, the Expert Welfare Working Group, came back with more than 40 recommendations, some of which you've done. Yes, some of which you've done. Some of which you've done. But its proposal was to lift benefit levels by up to 47%. That was the scale it was talking about. Now, are you in the next term not going to rule out, in fact, open about a significant adjustment to those basic benefit levels?
Firstly, and I will come directly to that, but we do need to take into account, as I just said, someone on a sole parent payment, on average, $100 more a week. That is significant, and I think that often gets forgotten.
It is, but their rents have moved up, as we have said.
And we've moved the accommodation supplement as well. So, going forward, we've already said we want the training incentive allowance back. We want people to keep more of their part-time work, so we'll change abatements. We haven't ruled out doing more there, but we've constantly got to make sure that we're doing it in a sustainable way as well.
Right, but not ruling out. Significant increase to basic benefit levels.
I haven't ruled out changes to benefit levels. No, I haven't. But we've also got to constantly make sure we can afford to do what we do.
You've said that climate change was your generation's nuclear-free moment. How has that been reflected in your government's actual initiatives enacted so far?
In everything we do. Whether it was the banning of offshore oil and gas exploration, the introduction of the Zero Carbon Act, we created the Climate Commission, so now we're going to get carbon budgets that help us stick to our plan and our targets. The work we've done on waste, the work we've done to transition towards renewable electricity generation, and we've brought forward our targets there. We're starting to build a hydrogen network. We've enhanced our EV network. We've put more money into public transport than any government.
Okay.
And now we need to keep going.
So let's have some sobering facts to match it. This year, 2020, New Zealand's CO2 equivalent emissions total will be its highest ever. The Ministry for the Environment doesn't expect our emissions to even reach their peak until 2025. We're not even close to turning the ship, are we?
Well, net emissions in 2018 came down only marginally, I accept that, but that is against a previous track of growth. Are we done yet? Of course not. You know, this has to be about our trajectory out to 2050. But again, you know, the foundations that we have started, including on the hardest of areas, which is industrial energy generation and agriculture, we've made progress. But Catherine, the thing for me is, when I came in to Parliament, I remember in opposition sitting on the bench watching as the ETS got unravelled. Whatever I do in this area has to stick. If I don't bring people with us, we won't see sustained change, and it cannot be a political football.
We're hearing that. However, from next year, as you've mentioned, the Climate Commission will be issuing carbon budgets indicating how far off the country is from meeting its international pledges.
And we did that.
Understood.
Yes.
Yes, but then there's the actual change.
Yeah, absolutely.
Change to those results.
Yep.
As things stand, and Ms. Collins challenged me on this yesterday, As things stand, it's highly likely we will be missing targets, potentially by as much as 100 million tonnes of CO2 equivalent. We're going to have to start paying for that, miss, from 2030. And what is it in your manifesto?
We already do through our emissions trading scheme.
But what is it in your manifesto that will change that track by 2030?
Well, again, we've got to look at the biggest contributors. So 48% of our emissions are coming from agriculture. There are significant inroads we can make together to continue the work that's already been done to improve the way that we farm. We will always be primary producers. Now we have to be primary producers that use the best tech to deliver our products in a carbon neutral way. And we can do that. The second, industrial heat. We've already said we want to phase out those low, medium heat use of coal boilers, for instance. We've got funds that we're using to support the private sector to transition. That is a significant contributor. And we have to decarbonise the public sector. We've made a start on that in schools and hospitals as well.
Transport is, of course, the biggest single source, right?
No, still agriculture is. But it is
roughly
20%.
The government's debt burden now, it's built up in the emergency response to COVID's impacts. What is your view of the debt levels and how they should be dealt with?
Well, I don't think it would be wise for us to ever just check ourselves against ourselves without looking at our relative position, which is pretty good. We got debt down when we came in. So our starting point is 20%, obviously because of our response to make sure we had the wage subsidy and so on. It peaks at 56 and then comes down again. Some countries went in at 80%. Yep. So that is worth keeping
in
mind.
So we're hitting 56%.
Peaking.
We've had three rainy days in the last 12 years,
yep,
and we may have more of them. I'm curious as to how that debt burden has changed your view of your government's priorities. What difference is it making to the way you're going to approach the next term if you get one?
I have always worried about debt. There has never been a point that I didn't look at everything we did with a view to, are we making sure that we are demonstrating fiscal responsibility?
What is your position on what should happen with that debt track? Are you comfortable with 15 years of deficits as things stand?
Again, I think that just to keep that perspective, because when we hear those numbers, you know, many countries are carrying 80%. So I wouldn't see it next year. Countries carry debt.
So it's tolerable?
It's tolerable, but we have to keep a lid on it. We have to be careful. Our debt track, we are working at making sure that we bring it down in a sustained way that doesn't see a cut to services, that doesn't see a cut to health and to education, that continues to invest in our people, because actually when you invest in our people, that also helps us grow our way out.
So 15 years of deficits under your fiscal plan, and you are comfortable carrying that and the risk attached?
It is not unusual, the position that we're in, and I do think that that's important. However, I have always been focused on our debt.
Do you believe the government you've led this term has been transformational?
Yes, I do. Because, you know, actually, I don't think anyone, I've used this quote a couple of times, because I don't think anyone ever said it better. Ruth Bader Ginsburg once said that change, real change, comes one step at a time. If we genuinely want to make sure that what we're doing on child poverty, what we're doing on climate change isn't just a three-year burst, I have to make sure it's sustained. It isn't going to happen just at once. We have to start the work, lay the foundation, and keep going. It took decades to create. I need more than 3 years to fix it.
The thing is, that is not the language of transformation. That is the language of incrementalism.
No, it's...
Which has been the last two governments, three-term governments.
Tell me one thing a government has done that has been transformational that didn't finish after 3 years. It's a hard question.
So are you accepting that actually incrementalism is the way to go?
Lasting change, but that doesn't mean that you can't be transformative.
Okay,
if we're going to move New Zealand to being a carbon neutral, clean, green country, you know, that is going to take a sustained effort, but we can do it. And I'm optimistic that we can do it.
Here's another example. You had another review being the tax review, another lengthy and thorough and complete review and complete report out of which you made effectively zero change. And the question is why? Because this was also about intergenerational fairness.
Mm.
And this was about the CGT now gone and ruled out forever, and the wealth tax now gone and ruled out forever.
Under me. The CGT.
Yeah.
Under me. And that's because I've tried three times. You know, I still believe in it, and I've said that, but I tried three times. New Zealand didn't agree with me. And when you're a politician, at some point you have to accept that people have sent a message. And they did. I campaigned on three occasions, and that was the final message from people.
You're on the progressive side of politics. What have you learned from the problems you've had actually delivering on some of the things I have highlighted this morning from 2017? What have you learned about what it takes and about what stops progress?
That MMP does create complex governments. If you want pace and speed, give us a strong mandate.
What will that mean if, as polls have suggested till now, you are forming a government perhaps needing the Greens? Will that mean more ambitious policies? Will that mean something like the water bottling ban, which was proposed at the last election and dropped, might be back on the table?
It wasn't actually dropped. It wasn't actually dropped.
Well, is it banned?
No, well, one of the issues that you have is that you can't just ban foreign bottling. You have to ban all of it because then you get into trade issues.
Well,
but it's a bit more of a complex
issue. I can't see the Greens opposing that.
Well, we are actually working on the way that we deal with, you know, just not only the issue of bottling water, but just the waste that comes from it, but from a plastics perspective. But I digress, Catherine. You know, for me, this question of, you know, who forms government, who we'd partner with, voters decide. They've already seen that I can work with the Green Party. I have. But let's see if that's the outcome come election day.
But you've alluded to MMP as being the complexity that has slowed some things.
With three parties. That is true.
With the Greens, does that suggest there will be an agenda in a Labour-Green government that is as ambitious or nearer as ambitious as your 2017 manifesto?
I've never lost that ambition, but to say that MMP does make these... MMP does make things slower. You've got to build consensus on everything. And so I'm not necessarily going to say that two parties won't still have a bit of, you know, that it won't be a bit slower as well. I want a mandate that allows us to get on with recovery. That's what I'm looking for.
Do you still want to govern alone? Is that your preference?
I'm campaigning for Labour, and that's my job.
Would you want to govern alone?
I'm here campaigning for Labour, Catherine. Always have been.
Would New Zealand First form part of a coalition government that you led if it weren't essential?
Yeah, I've never, you know, got into the, you know, where preferences would be. You know, voters decide that. People have already seen we can work with the Greens. They can see we can work with New Zealand
You've
First.
Also explained that the complexities of your arrangement this time
and then
slowed
voters,
you down.
Yeah,
they did. If you didn't need them, would you leave them out?
Voters will decide, but I will be looking for the most straightforward path through.
I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for yours.
And as I said to Ms. Collins yesterday, good luck for Saturday night.
Thank you very much.